When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 100. I am clapping alone in my office because I'm the only person who's here at the moment, other than my dog Scott, who is fervently licking his own butthole right now, which is how dogs celebrate things. Jesus Christ, Scott, what could possibly be in there that's so delicious? But this is very special. We've made it 100 episodes. We didn't build anything into the episode itself to say, hey, it's 100, but we did have Simon Pegg on, which to me is special enough to make that the 100th episode, so that is what we've done. We've also have a very special guest who drops by, Joel McHale! So, I'm sorry, I have a cold. But let me just tell you about a couple quick things. First of all, we are shooting the Nerdist TV pilot for BBC America in Los Angeles on the evening of Tuesday, June 28th, and I would like you to be a guest. Now, we only have 40 slots for audience members. The guest is Craig Ferguson. So, here's what I want to do. You have to come in costume if you want to come. Like Comic-Con style, you've got to rock a costume. So if you're willing to do that, email your name, age, why you should get one of the 40 slots, and what costume you want to wear to audience@nerdist.com. Submission deadline is Friday, June 24th. Also, Comic-Con show. Nerdist Podcast live at Comic-Con, July 23rd. That's a Saturday. And Nerdist is coming to Montreal, the Just for Laughs Festival on July 28th. Go to nerdist.com for all of that information. Also, some great shows coming up at Nerd Melt. Nerdist at Meltdown, June 20th. We're doing a Nerdist podcast live with Tom Lennon and Ben Garant. Also, June 23rd, David Koechner and Dana Gould bring Carnyville to Nerd Melt. And July 7th, Jackie Cation ports Dork Forest live at Nerd Melt. Go to meltcomics.com to get information and tickets for all those. And June 30th, in San Francisco, Nerdist is co-presenting An Evening with Children's Hospital. Rob Corddry, Rob Hubel, Aaron Hayes, Lake Bell, Paul Scheer, June Raphael, and Jonathan Stern will all be there. Go to sfsketchfest.com if you want to get information for that and you live in San Francisco and you're free June 30th. Or maybe you're not free and you just want to cancel your plans. That works too. Creepy hugs, you know, the kind your uncle gives you. He's not really your uncle, but he hangs around your parents so much they call him your uncle. GoToMeeting.com by Citrix. This is web conferencing. They've won just about every award in that field that you could possibly win. And yes, there are awards for that field because web conferencing is the thing that we need now. But forget about awards. Think about what customers think, people who actually use it all the time. They say the UI is simple and smart, dynamic. They're thrilled they've switched. You can schedule in advance or on the fly. Everyone sees your computer desktop on their screen. You can collaborate on files and documents in real time. Yes, it is available for Mac or PC. You can use GoToMeeting for product reviews, demos, sales presentations, training sessions, weekly status meetings, adult goings-on. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial of GoToMeeting. Hold all the meetings you want for one low flat rate. Phone and voice over IP conferencing is included for free. So visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, enter the promo code Nerdist. And now, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 100, holy cats, with Simon Pegg and super secret guest Joel McHale. I know, don't tell me on Twitter that I gave it away. I know I gave it away, because I know how words work. But I have to tell you, it was so much fun kind of watching them nerd out over each other, because they are actually
fans of each other, so it was really fun to hang out with everyone. We had an amazing time, so I hope you do as well. Thanks for listening to the announcements, and enjoy the episode. Freaking love you so much.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
This equipment looks like it does stuff, but it's, look, we're still recording everything onto CDs.
Did you press play and record?
I did at the same time.
At the same time.
Good.
Yeah.
Got to dub the tapes afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
Make it sound real fast.
So we're going to get two tape players back and forth and then make like radio shows.
Yeah. How else am I supposed to get my Faith No More tapes from my friend?
It's pretty sweet. Faith No More. I was making fucking Neil Diamond tapes. I'm a little older than you.
That's true.
Simon Pegg is here. Simon, hey. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my absolute pleasure.
Well, it is our incredible pleasure to have you here, as we are enormous fans of your work.
Oh, thank you very much.
And I don't know, I don't expect you to remember this because it all happened so fast and there was a stabbing, but I moderated the panel for Paul at Comic-Con last year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When we were about to go on stage and security came back and said, everyone back upstairs.
Yeah, how could I forget? It was like Altamont for nerds. News came back. It was weird, wasn't it? It was like, someone's been stabbed.
Yeah.
And then it was...
the Hell's Angels.
Someone was mildly poked in the head with a pen, I think is what happened.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, like 50 feet from Hall H that you can buy Morning Stars and maces. And then it was like, mechanical pencil, the nerd switchblade, click, click, stab.
It was kind of weird though, because they like locked the whole place down, and it was all, everything went a bit weird for a while, and we didn't know what because as far as we were concerned, someone had been gutted with a replica Klingon sword.
A badly.
Those are around too. It's so weird walking into Comic-Con too and having the weapons check.
Yeah.
It's like, put your swords and shit here.
I know though, but if there was ever a place for someone to just go mental and just like go through and just start throwing a katana into people.
Surprise, it hasn't happened before. Surprise, there hasn't really been a history of violence at Comic-Con.
It is a surprise, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'd expect
a history
that
of violence
more.
Really wouldn't market to Comic-Con. I don't know why that movie.
All right,
would
so you're
play.
Referencing a movie that was very clever wordplay on your part.
Comic book.
Listen, they market anything at Comic-Con now. Come on.
Seriously, so what are the cons like? Were there must have been cons when you were growing up. Tell us about the British nerdscape, because you and I are about the same age. Tell us about the British nerdscape when you were growing up.
Well, it was in its infancy. It wasn't the kind of, you know, commercial beer moth that it is now. It was just about being into kind of like stuff, and people who liked football didn't like you. That was kind of it, you know. When there was that, obviously Star Wars was the explosion in the mid-70s, and then everything kind of changed, and various nerd tribes sort of emerged from that. There were the Star Wars fans, and they're the people that thought the black hole was better, and,
right.
You know, idiots. And there's just various kind of... for me, it was like there was Star Wars, and then I was into the Incredible Hulk and Marvel Comics as well between films, and then Empire came out, and then I was E.T. mad until Jedi came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just sucking up American culture, really, because it, you know, all the sort of nerdy stuff was, apart from Doctor Who, of course. I note your T-shirt.
Yes, Dalek on. I Dalek London. Well, and you were in The Long Game.
I was.
Yeah, I'm just going to start naming episodes. I mean, you got to be on Doctor Who.
I was weird. I mentioned it in the book, but I did meet Tom Baker when I was 8, and who was my Doctor Who, you know,
yes.
When I was a kid, when it was much less, I mean, when the production values were laughable.
Black box theater and a rubber mask?
Just a play on TV.
That scarf was the most expensive set piece.
I never noticed all the household appliances sprayed silver when I was 8, but you do now. And
they learned everything from Plan 9.
Yeah, it was amazing. It kind of is sad in a way that we're just not that prepared to suspend our disbelief anymore. Do you know what I mean? You watch, right. You know, do you remember when the Iron Man trailer first broke and the CG wasn't quite up to scratch?
Yes.
Yeah.
And people were like, this is terrible! And yet it was still kind of photorealistic and expensive looking.
Yeah.
In those days, you could be killed with a whisk and you go, oh my God, he's dead!
they did preserve the whisk and the sink plunger on the Daleks to this day. Yeah. It's like, they're still there.
Yeah, I love the fact they do that. So, it was a hodgepodge, mishmash. It was much, now it's been, you know, they've cottoned on to the fact that it sells now. And you look at all the big films of summer, they're all kind of nerd territory, really.
Of course. Yeah.
But
some to a more successful degree than others, I think.
Exactly. But yeah, it was more of a hand to mouth kind of deal back in the day.
Do you think the business is going to cannibalize nerd culture the way it does when it feels like, ah, there's money here, and then everyone starts making nerd films, nerd-themed films, but they're not nerds who are making them, so a lot of them are going to be shitty, and then they're going to go away?
Yeah, it has done. Absolutely has done. I think that's already been hegemonized, as I would have said, at university.
Yes.
Because it's, it did seem profitable. I think generally the populace have a kind of tendency to want to regress a little bit and be children because the world's a horrible place, and so these things appeal to them. Star Wars is a great example of a mass infantile regression, post-Vietnam mass infantile regression. That's what Star Wars was in many ways. And that's just got more and more and more over the years, and people have cottoned onto that. So there are people out there who go, yeah, I'm a nerd, and they're not.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there are people making films that are kind of nerdy, and they're not.
Well,
so
there's even like the younger generation, the kids in high school right now are just getting out of high school. They're even like trying to regress even further, and they're already pretty young. So you see these kids dressing like with animal heads on and, you know, raccoon tails on their keychains and, you know, dressing up like Pokemon characters. It's weird that it's like, and they're reminiscing about stuff that they shouldn't be allowed to reminisce about yet.
Right.
They haven't gained, you know, the thought process to be like, oh, that was a good time, you know, 3 years ago when I was in fifth grade.
Well, that's because nostalgia is catching up with the present. And when that, it's like these two things are coming together, and eventually there'll be a show on VH1 called I Love 6 Months Ago.
Yes.
And then when that becomes like I Love Yesterday, that's when Armageddon.
I think it was called Best Week Ever.
Remember when that shirt you had on was the one you've got on now? Yes. I'm living in the present.
Remember this morning? Oh, man.
Fucking great.
Talking heads sort of talking about what they have for breakfast that morning. It will be that will be the end of the world.
Did I read that you actually didn't? Did you do your, did you do a thesis paper on the whole idea? Idea of hegemony.
Like, I did a whole thesis on Star Wars and related works. So all that, you know, that was around at the time, the sort of late 70s, early 80s popular cinema, all about how when you watch those films, any kind of innate or in sort of and anything that they might be saying, not purposefully, but anything they might be coming across, if you don't notice that, then you're agreeing with it. So if a film's a little bit sexist and you don't go, hey, that's sexist, then you are a sexist.
Interesting.
So like for instance in Star Wars, in Raiders, in Wrath of Khan, all those films are there's a lot of bomb fear in those films. Mm-hmm. A lot of fear of big weapons, like, you know, the Genesis Project and the Death Star and the Force and the Ark. And that was on our minds at the time. Everyone was worried about nuclear war, that we were going to get bombed by the Russians, and everyone was terrified that they'd hear the siren any second. And those films are all about big weapons being okay in the hands of good people and wrong in the hands of bad people.
Mm-hmm.
So the Genesis Project is a force of life with the Federation, but it's bad. The Klingons get hold of it. The Death Star is bad. The Force is good. The Ark, if you don't look at it, that's the brilliant bit. Don't look at it and it'll be all right. That's basically saying, we'll do all the nuclear stuff and you just get on with your life.
So you just have to just do this. Put your hand
close
over
your eyes. Kids. Yeah. And you'll be fine.
Really?
That's how they don't die. That's how they don't melt. Yep. They just don't look at it.
Yep.
And that was like a sort of, you know, I don't think Steven Spielberg was making a point, but all that stuff is bubbling in our subconscious.
Don't look at the gun. It can't shoot you if you don't look at his gun.
<I know. laughs> So that was fun to sort of like analyze all those movies like that.
Were there besides Doctor Who, what were some of the other what were British kind of nerd? I mean, back then I didn't think of them as this is nerd culture. I just thought of it as these are things I like.
Yeah.
And you know, of course I watched the Bill Bixby Incredible Hulk, and I watched any kind of sci-fi, huge Twilight Zone geek.
The Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man, do you remember that one? The Spider-Man, live-action Spider-Man.
It was short-lived.
Very short-lived.
I remember, is that the one where he discovers he has the powers because he's about to get hit by a car and he jumps up and sticks to the wall? Or did I dream that?
I bought a VHS of that at a Star Trek convention.
I mean, the costume looks like pajamas.
Can I just say that's probably the nerdiest thing that will be said today?
With him in the room, it's gonna get worse. He already is. Yeah,
91 nerdy year too.
Very nerdy, vintage. Yeah, that was. He was very skinny, and the special effects were kind of quite good for TV because he was up high walls and stuff, wasn't he? There was stuff, the British output, Blake 7, Tripos, the Day of the Triffids serialization, all similar production values to Doctor Who. A lot of children's programming was pretty trippy and kind of, you know, they did Chocky, the other Wyndham, John Wyndham story. All very, but all our production values were so inferior because there's just not as much money in television in the UK.
Right.
So even like something like The Incredible Hulk, the Bill Bixby one, still looked really flashy and expensive to us. Even though when I look back at it now, there's a clip when the Hulk is fighting a bear. And it's not only is it a man in a bear suit, but all the green paint is coming off onto its fur.
No, he's absorbing the
Hulk. He's absorbing the radiation. Yeah, right. He's absorbing the gamma radiation.
Keep telling yourself that.
Oh, bear what, Hulk.
Yeah, bears also don't like tilt from side to side waving
in,
their arms.
Hercules in New York, the Schwarzenegger one.
Yes,
when he fights the bear in Central Park.
Right. And then the Hulk throws it. They're fighting in the water, which was a stupid idea because, of course, the green paint was going to come off. But it meant that you couldn't see his little bally shoes that he wore. And then he throws the bear, and it looks like someone has literally thrown a teddy bear. And it kind of goes...
But I do remember, like, and also, did you guys get to $6 Million Man?
Oh, yeah, I'm massively a big fan of that.
I mean, that toy when I was a kid where you could look through the back of his head and see through the eye. And,
but like, the eye made it look further away. It was like... Wait a minute, I should be able to see molecules, not the distance.
I like the idea that we accepted the fact that putting him into super slow motion meant he was going really fast. Like that was their way around
brilliant
that
logic. Yeah. And he had that the action figure had a little arm that he had it held an engine. Do you remember this? He had like a rubber skin over an arm.
And you pull it off.
You peeled it back like a weird sort of foreskin.
Yes.
And there were little bionic things in his arm. And then you pushed a button on his back and he lifted up an engine. It was such a strange...
That fucking toy did like two things, but for some reason it
did them really well.
It kept me enraptured for months.
I had this one, and I was so excited to have it, but it was called Maskatron. And he was... I don't know if he had ever appeared in the show, but he was... It was an action figure that came with Steve Austin that you know, it was like a part of the Steve Austin line. He was silver and all his arms and legs came off and he had an Oscar Goldman face, a Steve Austin face.
Oh, they came off?
Yeah, and he had a Maskatron face and they all came off and he was like a sort of master of disguise android.
I remember that.
And then when he took the mask off, it was just like a...
Yes,
he was in the show. I remember that.
Yes, 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 because they also did a... But they did a, because this is so funny, like there was so much Sasquatch news at the time, they did a bionic Sasquatch.
They did. And he was friendly. And he had a funny eye. And then, do you remember Barney, the $7 million man?
No!
Yeah, Barney.
They upped it $1 million?
They did. Yeah, they spent an extra million on this one.
We have one more million to make this guy.
He had like two bionic arms. But Barney couldn't cope with it. The emotional strain of his new limbs, and they dialed him down to normal. Even when I was a kid, I was like, that's convenient.
That is right.
Turn him down.
Yeah,
so he's just a normal guy that just can't get in water.
Yeah,
that's pretty
exactly,
much his, yeah.
Yeah, he'll break.
Yeah. They just put him down to two or three on the knob. All right, you're fine. Yeah,
off you go.
I'm still bionic, though. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know.
You could lift a really heavy box.
But you want to lift with your legs, so you want to make sure to lift with your legs.
You could work for a removal firm or, you know, perhaps do some packing and loading, but crime fighting, no.
So when did you start doing – you did stand-up as well.
Yes, I did, yeah.
When did you start doing stand-up?
When I was a kid, kind of. I mean, I started playing with it this sort of, you know, standing up in front of people and telling jokes. And when I got to university and I realized that being an actor would mean, you know, having to be at the mercy of a lot of chance and casting directors, I thought, well, I like stand-up and maybe this is the way I can have a bit of autonomy in my career and, you know, have some say. I'm a control freak, basically. So I started doing stand-up and that is what sort of took me to London and led me back into acting and stuff.
Was there any kind of a stand-up scene where you were from in England? Or did you have to seek it out?
I had to go to London. You have to put a sort of knapsack on your back. You have to put a handkerchief wrapped up on a stick and walk to London.
Notebook on the inside and a bottle of water.
There are a foldable stool.
And your little a brick wall that you can just expand and put behind you.
That's exactly what I had to do.
How much can that hold? Just hold on. There's more audience members start getting out.
Now there's in the bigger cities like Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, there are comedy clubs. But I was from a little market town called Gloucester, and it wasn't really happening there. the most famous people from Gloucester, as it stands, are me and a serial killer called Fred West.
Fred West. He sounds handsome.
Oh, no.
What's fascinating, it's just the whole idea is fascinating to me because I feel like we take for granted now because with the internet, all information is available at all times to all people. And so everyone knows pretty much like, oh, you can, you know, in theory, you can pretty much do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But I feel like when we were growing up, there wasn't really that, there wasn't really a sense of that, like, oh, I can just go do stand-up because that's a thing that people can just go do. So what do you think it was about you that made you think, I mean, you have probably three channels of television.
Yeah, there was at the time, yeah.
And pretty much radio and nothing else. So, like, what made you think, you know, I think I can go tell jokes to people for a living?
I don't know. I think it was either stupidity or disillusionment. I kind of, when I was a kid, I never thought about being an actor until I was about 50, even though I was, you know, doing it like community theater and I loved it. But I never thought I would be entitled to actually get to do it for a career. That's ridiculous. And it wasn't until I was 15 that this course came up at this drama college in Stratford-on-Avon, where our dear Shakespeare was born, and offered the chance to do a sort of like theater studies course, which I then went and did. And that led to going to Bristol University, which has a great drama course. And during that time, that's when I was in a much bigger metropolis then, and stand-up felt like something that you could do for a living. It was the early 90s, so it was off the back of that huge comedy revolution after The Young Ones and the comic strip. And so it felt like culturally it was relevant, and it was something, it wasn't really that rarefied. It was like, it was an option. But it took a little while. I did feel like Luke Skywalker when I was a kid. I was in a place where if there was a bright center to the universe, I was in the village it was farthest from. and I look back on it now, you know, watching the premiere of Star Wars in like May 77 on the TV on my little black and white, whatever it was, three channel TV, and seeing Grauman's Chinese and like thinking, no, I'll never be there. I'll never be there, governor.
With your chimney sweep and your fingerless gloves.
I wish I could get there, but no, I won't.
Boy, get back in that chimney.
When I stepped out of the Star Trek premiere there, I was like, I'm here! I told you I'd get here! Everyone just thought I was mad.
Still dressed like a chimney sweep?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still hung up on the Young Ones. I still...
Oh, it was like punk for comedy. It was, you know.
I mean, one of the greatest things that MTV ever did was to air The Young Ones in the States in the 80s. Because we just didn't have access to that kind of thing. And it just, watching that show for a young American, because, you know, a lot of nerdy American kids were total comedy expats. Like, we absorbed so much of your comedy because it just spoke to us in a different way. It was it was academic, and it was but also filthy in a wonderful way, and, you know, really influenced.
Yeah, it was massive. It was like the first time a school of comedy emerged that was just for young people, you know. I mean, Python even was very, very smart and a little erudite, and it was for adult, you know, for young adults at least, but The Young Ones was for the kids.
Yeah.
And it was like punk. It was like spitting, angry punk, but comedy. And it was seismic for all of us, you know.
Did you, in the early 90s, which also brought us the Happy Mondays, thrills, pills, and bellyaches, just taking the chance. Were you in the Chris Morris circle?
I was, yeah. I was like a young member of that gang. I watched The Day Today, which was
one of my favorite shows.
Yeah, the incredible
Kitty Stare.
Yeah. Fighting for the pleasure of adults. Which was that felt like the most amazing comedy show ever. You know, it was so brilliantly done, so serious. You know, they did it. News faced. Those are the headlines. God, I wish they weren't. And then when we came to make Big Train, which is a kind of post-Python sketch show, you know, all done very seriously, very much in the next thing after the day-to-day, Chris Morris directed the pilot of that. And I also participated in a Brass Eye pedophile special.
That's fantastic. It's a great episode.
in which I played a guy called Gerard Choate, who was a campaigner for the organization Militped, a militant pedophile organization. I remember when Chris called me and said, "We come and have lunch with me. I want to talk to you about something." And we had this little dinner. He said, "I'm going to do something. It's going to get us into real trouble. Are you in?" I was like, "Yeah." So, yeah, the bit, for those of you who haven't seen it, I storm the studio, and then it cuts to commercials, and then it comes back, I'm in stocks, and then Chris is like, you know, you're campaigning for pedophile rights and all this kind of stuff. And here's my son. He's 6 years old. Do you want to have sex with him? And I go, no. He says, why not? Are you telling me you don't want to have sex with my son? No, I don't. Why not? I don't fancy him. And then he gets all annoyed because I don't fancy his son. Which, of course, says a lot about the way that adults sexualize children. You know, that show was the right wing and our sort of Republicans went mental. There were stories in the press about prisoners trading it on VHS to get off on in prison.
Oh,
and stuff.
Jesus.
And yet it was satirizing the very approach that they used to, you know, showing that kind of stuff in the media.
That's what got Breast Like canceled, right?
No, it already stopped. Chris, oh, okay. Yeah, that was like a one-off last V sign, as we say, to the media.
So then what was it, I'm curious to, like, when did you start really kind of expressing all of the nerdy stuff that was in your brain? Was it Red Dwarf that kind of, or what was it that made you say, you know what, maybe you didn't even make the conscious choice, but just a lot of the movies that you started writing and making, it just like all this great nerdy stuff is being expressed.
Well, it was Spaced, and it was because, I guess probably Kevin Smith after Clerks, because that film, you know, there's that great bit in that when they talk about the second Death Star and whether it was, you know, morally correct to destroy it because of all the workers that have been brought in. And I remember watching that and thinking, hey, he's just talking about that in a film. You can talk about that stuff in a film? And Jessica Hines, then Stevenson, and me had been working with Edgar Wright on a show called Asylum, which is a bizarre little thing on the Paramount Comedy Channel. I'd brought Jess in because I'd worked with her on something. Edgar came in and we were so impressed with his direction, you know, because he was clearly a gifted, very gifted director then. And they approached us and said, do you want to do a sitcom? Can we make a vehicle for you? And Jess and me said, yeah, but we want to write it. And at the time there was all these shows like, I mean, I you know, I like Friends. I'll watch it. It's like a screensaver for the mind sometimes. But, if there's nothing else on and Friends is on, you're right, I'll watch this.
Yeah, Friends, it's on.
It's on. And
it'll distract you.
Yeah.
There it is.
It'll keep me awake for another 20
this
minutes.
This are flashing colors. This are flashing colors.
Exactly. But there were other shows like Coupling, which is a British show.
Oh, yeah, Stephen Moffat.
Game On. Yeah, but all respect to Stephen, who's a fantastic guy, but Coupling said nothing to me about my life. It was just all these kind of good-looking, smarmy 20-somethings in a wine bar I've never been to, talking about things that didn't interest me.
And they tried to make that show so many times in America.
I know, but it was Friends. It was, we were ripping off Friends. That's what Coupling was. It was like, you know, the snake eating its own self. So we realized that we wanted to make a sitcom that talked about the things that we were into, and we wanted to talk to a very specific group of people. So that's why we made Spaced, which is full of all, you know, that was us just being us and talking about the stuff we're into, video games and science fiction and Star Wars betrayal and all that stuff, you know.
And you really, and up to that point, people, I don't know, it's, I guess it was just the coming of age of our generation that just needed to kind of get all that stuff out.
Yeah, but it was amazing because we didn't know if anyone was going to like it. We made a show that we wanted to watch, and the people started to, you know, were furiously devoted to it. You know, it was lovely how, because a lot of people felt like we were speaking to them personally, which we kind of were. So this website sprang up, Spaced Out, and we had these loyal fans, and it just grew and grew and grew. And then the next thing you know, we're sat doing a commentary on it with Quentin Tarantino.
Matt, grab another disc, will you?
Yeah.
That one took a crap, but we're recording on two discs, so everything's okay.
Thank
Special
God.
Two disc set. And now what's exciting about these types of shows is not only are they kind of nerdy themed, but as an American, it gives us the chance to seek out, like almost go on a quest to find, like, we've brought this chalice back from a faraway land, you know? And so it kind of, it speaks to us even more because we have to do a little bit of work to get to it.
Well, it's similar for us. I mean, you know, with American comedy, that's like shows like Mr. Show or whatever that didn't air on British TV, that you had to kind of, you know, seek out some of the more, you know, the Adult Swim stuff that's not necessarily on. It's always fun when you find that stuff. I love the fact, when I just worked with Bill Hader on Paul, and we have the same experience of like finding stuff. Like he said, he was watching like Garth Marenghi, Dark Place in his trailer when he was making Hot Rod or something.
Oh, it's funny. I was watching it in my single apartment, but we all have our own experiences with different things.
It wasn't a full track.
I had to rip it off a disc that someone sent to me. They made a copy. Listen, guys, scientists, stop trying to create a unified field theory. We need to fucking unify the media regions.
Yeah.
Can't we just can't we just have the same region coding? What is the fucking problem?
I became kind of popular amongst my friends because I, like, you know, went out to a place and bought an all region player that you had to put the code in to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I also, like, on off of Amazon was buying, like, Garth Marenghi and Look Around You.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, Brass Eye, like all these, you know, British things. And, like, so we'd always like, hey, come over and bring your stuff. And just, I would bring it out, hook it up, put the code on. I was the guy that brought my friend's British comedy.
That's what we had to do, though, because initially with DVD, all the American DVD releases were so much better. They were, there was more extras. They were, it's kind of more in alignment now. But everyone had region, anyone who was like a film buff had region free players in the UK, so we could watch American DVDs. It was kind of like, it is like a fight against, and now on the internet, you know, I can't see anything on American.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
You guys have a great show that I've only ever seen a snippet of called The Gadget Show.
Yeah.
It's very simple, The Gadget Show. And when you try to pull clips from it, it's like, oh, you are not authorized to in this region. I'm like, and I get so mad at the internet. Like, internet, what are you doing?
I know. It's like, what's wrong with
this?
This
is why I have to download Bargain Hunt.
How many fucking, how many sneezing cat videos?
Sorry, that is the most nitty thing that we said. Yes.
Oh, he loves Bargain Hunt. Loves Bargain Hunt.
Down.
I just need to, you know, I just need to fucking start torrenting everything.
That's what I do.
You know what? I'm you know, the whole with the movies and stuff, it's abhorrent and it's killing the industry and we all know that. But when it comes to television, if it's only some advertising exec that's losing out because I'm not watching the commercial breaks in the show that I want to watch, then
right.
I'm less opposed to, you know, when Lost was on and it was on. I was a big fan of the show, and it was on a lot later. My sister knew how to get it to me quicker than the television did, and I was quite happy to do that.
I've been downloading Top Gear since 2002, like since the other guy was there, not James May.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I just sort of feel like
per episode,
I will always just as a manner of honor, I will try to get things in the conventional way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if they're not available, it's like, well, what choice do I have?
Listen,
you're
I
making me steal it.
Gladly split a TV licensing fee with someone in the UK so I can.
So you can get Bargain Hunt.
Sling box it over.
Yeah. Well, now that this podcast is becoming a show on BBC America.
Oh, excellent.
So we will actually, I guarantee you, Matt Myra, we'll be able to get you episodes of Bargain Hunt.
All right. If you can get me on, I prefer the blue team.
All right. I don't know what you're talking about. I've never seen Bargain Hunt.
See, BBC America is very interesting because that's the way, you know, that's obviously responding to the demand for cross-pollination, do you know what I mean?
That is, right.
I love the fact that I was in Austin yesterday and I switched on the TV and Doctor Who was on and it was a new Doctor Who.
Yes.
There was billboards in the city for the new season.
And it's like, oh, good. But it's still... Having just worked with like Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, I wanted to see them on SNL, you know, in the UK because we don't have a live comedy show. I know that show can be patchy, but it's like, it's incredible that there is a live comedy show on Saturday nights on network television.
90 minutes too.
Just 90 minutes long. And I love the guys that are on it but I cannot see it in the UK because it's not shown there and NBC won't let me watch it on my computer. And what have I done?
The internet... NBC, why are you mad at Simon Pegg? Come on, you're supposed to watch a comedy show.
Yeah. You're related to Universal. I've made some films for you. I should have a special password or something.
Well, we're going to have to check that with our superiors.
Really? You can't just...
But I did Shaun of the Dead.
Those are my friends I want to watch.
Which, I mean, of course, I would love to talk about Shaun of the Dead for a couple minutes because, I mean, you know, again... When that movie came out, that was another one of those moments. And I fear I will only have only a few of these moments left in my life where I get to watch something and go, oh, my God, you can do it that way. Because we see so much and we get so jaded so easily that – and I feel like that's a limited resource that you have.
Right.
But you did that with that movie. And even just like just subtle things like the slip in the convenience store, I mean, I don't even have words to express to you what that did for me as a horror fan and as a comedy fan, that movie. Yeah. And it's still, by the end of it, it's like, and it's very sincere at the same time.
I have a little regret about that moment because when we shot it, when I come back into the house and I put my feet up on the table and I'm watching TV, there should have been a little something on the bottom.
Yeah.
I always think like, yeah.
Are you super control freaky that way where you watch back and you go, God damn it, we didn't have that day.
Weirdly enough, me and Edgar, we did a triple bill screening of Sean Hot Fuzz and the other film he did. And the amazing Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And we did it at the New Beverly. And we sat together and watched our films, you know, or two of them, for the first time in a long time. And it was interesting watching it together and sort of saying, I might have done that differently. And like Hot Fuzz, we would have cut by about 10 minutes, I think. We were like,
don't say that.
No, we're just little nips and
tucks. Yeah.
But you can't ever... I can understand why George Lucas went back and fiddled with the stuff, but you shouldn't do it.
Right.
No, you shouldn't do it.
Especially because, you know, it's he's going back to 1977 George Lucas's mind.
Yeah.
And saying like, oh, this is the stuff that I wanted to, and then kind of not realizing like, yeah, but it's, you know, like if Da Vinci were alive today, he shouldn't go back and go, I should have put a mole on her cheek. Yeah, you know,
exactly.
Like, fucking leave it.
But it's also the thing of like, you know, there's footage of him talking when he was that age saying, you know, special effects are a tool to help a story and they're not the story itself. And then he goes back and fucks things up like that. It's like when I was 7 years old with my mouth hanging open thinking my life has changed, I didn't think this scene would be amazing if there was a Jawa in the background falling off a dinosaur. Right, that would really improve this film.
Weird, I thought that.
It's funny though, because you think about like, say like a punk band, like, and they record an album and it's great, everyone loves it, then they get a lot of money to like do a better album, like better production, better instruments, and it's just not that good.
Yeah.
And it's like it was good because of what they had and what would they work with.
That word is, you know, overproduced.
We had an interesting thing with Super 8 and Paul both use the same piece of music. There's a strange synchronicity between the two films. And I saw Super 8 the other night and I really enjoyed it. And I because I've worked for JJ, I was able to email him and go, that was really good. apparently he really had to fight to get the original version of Don't Bring Me Down. And because Paul was lower budget, we couldn't afford it. So we've got the overproduced one and JJ's got the original one, which is, you know, you decide which is best.
I really think not having a huge budget is a service to the people that are making a film because it forces you to be more creative.
It absolutely does. And it also means there's less fiddling from the powers that be who want to ensure they get their money back.
Right.
Who are, you know, friends and helpers, but sometimes... when a film is made by committee, it just, you know, it loses its edge a little bit.
Yeah, in singular voice.
Yeah, exactly. And with a film like Sean, you know, it was very low budget. We were completely left alone. We didn't know it was going to come out in the US. We made one tiny concession in the writing process that in case it ever got seen in America, in case like guys like you got a VHS of it, which was when we find Mary, Bloody Mary, in the garden and we think she's drunk. Initially in the script, I say, oh man, she's pissed. and of course, you guys would see that as being she's annoyed.
Yeah, right.
The joke wouldn't work. So we changed it to drunk. And that was the only concession we made for America. And yet it's been so sort of taken to people's hearts here without us making any compromises whatsoever. You know, it just proves that people are smart and the cinema going audience is an intelligent bunch if challenged.
Yeah, I know. And the studios are still convinced that people are idiots.
Like, I know. It's kind of worrying.
Like, really? You know? Because we have a bunch of examples of that not being the case.
Yeah. And they blind you with like, well, in this quadrant, the demographic are tested higher than ever before. And you're like, what are you talking about?
Take it down, college boy.
I remember being upset when I first heard about Shaun of the Dead because me and BJ Porter, a writer for Mr. Show, we started piecing together a zombie comedy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just like we started beating it out. We'd meet up and like have like more scenes started to put together. And then like... another comedy writer out here, Ken Daly, was like, hey, there's a movie coming out in England called Shaun of the Dead. I was like, oh, fuck, that's a perfect name. but you know, he's all, I don't really know much about it. I was like, you know, it's okay. It's like, if it might still be getting made, we can still work this through. And we started, kept on going. And then he came back. He's like, I have a copy of it. It's really fucking good. I was like, well, let's watch it. So like, it was months and months before it came out in the U.S. We got a copy of it, and I just, like, the whole time, like, just, like, so delighted and pissed off at the same time. This is like a fuck you. Oh, fuck you. But it was it was perfect. As I'm a huge zombie fan and like and a huge nerd of comedy, but like it was like perfect combination.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of when I first saw Return of Living Dead as a kid.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Where I was young enough to where I didn't know it was supposed to be a comedy.
Right, right.
And I was like, this is a crazy awesome zombie movie. And then I got older, I realized it was
human. Yeah.
But an American studio never would have made Shaun of the Dead that way, because they would have been like, you keep those sincere moments out of it. It's either a fucking comedy or it's a zombie movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, weirdly enough, I just did a film with John Landis that I think IFC are going to release over here, sort of limited, called Burke and Hare. And it's about these two, a real true story of these two guys in Edinburgh in 1828 who realized they could make lots of money by killing people and selling the bodies to the medical profession.
Oh, wow.
Who were doing, That's anatomy. Awesome. And it's great. I was working with one of my heroes, and it's a really nice little movie.
When I saw Hot Fuzz, John Landis three rows behind me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's like, American Werewolf was my first horror film that I sat through and thought I can watch horror and not be mentally disturbed. But he was saying when he did Animal House, he showed a cut of it to the the really old school Hollywood guys, the cigar chompers, in a screening room at the studio, and the bit when Otter gets beaten up and he's quite wounded, this execs are going, what the fuck is this? This ain't funny. What the fuck? Like, I'm really annoyed that there could be some kind of nuance in comedy, you know.
Yeah. Did you ever hear a rumor that John Landis was the one that shot that Sasquatch footage, just bringing it back to Sasquatch?
We could ask him right now if you like.
Oh my God.
Wait.
I totally forgot. You're like the super internet. Like, you really have access.
The Peterson footage?
Yeah.
Wow.
He there was some interview where he admitted it once and then didn't, and then never admit, and then denied it.
Fuck. That'd be awesome.
That's good.
He also shot the picture of Nessie.
Yes, he definitely did that.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever been to Loch Ness?
No, never.
It's weird, because
I have been there, yes.
Have you? It's like, I know there's not a monster swimming around in that lake, but God, that feels like there is. It's really, it's
just
electric.
Creepy.
Yeah, it's really creepy. It's fantastic.
I did it. I took a tour of Scotland just by car, just driving on the wrong side of the car, on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah.
And we got through all the locks, and they are, I guess you're like, well, we have lakes here. What's the big fucking difference? But there's just something about just the gorgeous still water and Scotland. It's so haunting.
The potential of it all, and the mountains and the mist. And it's like, it's a classic place for a monster to live.
Do I hear a Simon Pegg Loch Ness Monster movie?
Hey, listen, after the water horse, you just couldn't do it.
You just couldn't do it again.
Just couldn't do it.
They
couldn't
really...
Yeah, we'll call it... It's like a horse and water. We'll call it Water Horse
2.
What about the one with Ted Danson? And there's another one called... It's called Loch Ness. And it's with a little girl and Ted Danson. And
really?
Thinking of Cheers.
No, it's absolutely true. And it contains the line... No, Mr. Dempsey, you've got to believe it before you can see it.
The writer's perfect antibiotic for any script problems.
You just have to believe.
Yeah.
Really? You sure that's all?
That's
so lazy.
Don't you think there has to be a creature there?
Anywho.
So also, Paul, fantastic. Another like hilarious movie with wonderful moments that is also sincere, but at the same time...
That was
so many great comedy moments.
That was a very interesting experience talking about working with a studio, because that was a more expensive film, and we knew going in that we couldn't make Shaun of the Dead with an effect that cost $20 million. Making Paul himself, the actual alien, which is a beautiful piece of work from Double Negative in the UK, who are an FX company, was like hiring Will Smith. It was like having Will Smith. It was that expensive to make him. And so Nick and I had to sit down and kind of go, okay, we got to open this up. We got to make this a little bit more inclusive, and make those when we do reference other movies, maybe bring in some more people, not just our mates, And that was a challenge for us, because we like being very niche, and we like make things being very small, but it had to be bigger.
Yeah, but it was like hiring Will Smith, but his face was more expressive.
Yeah. So whoosh.
Scratch.
Do you feel the pressure, though? Because I feel like what happens is a lot of people, they'll achieve a certain level of success because they're able to just sort of fly under the radar and make whatever they want. And then all of a sudden, spotlight's on you.
Yeah,
someone's giving you $100 million.
Yeah.
Do you even think about this stuff at night, or are you able to compartmentalize and just go, I'm just going to still do the same stuff I did before?
Well, the thing is, you can't. That's the thing. When it's, Paul was about 40, I guess, to make, and which is still much more than we've ever used before. And you know, you unless you're the Coen brothers or someone who is just absolutely trusted to go off and do their thing, you know, you have to collaborate and you have to give and take to get something made. I'm very, very I love Paula. It's a film that I have an enormous affection for because it was an absolute hoot to make. And there's a man I know.
Hey, come on in.
Joe McHale's just turned up.
It's Joe McHale who stopped by. A surprise celebrity visit. See, look at these two hugging it out.
I love you on Doctor Who.
Oh, I think you're grand community.
Oh. welcome.
Can I have a box set of season two, please?
Yes, you may.
Joel, thank sit
you.
At that microphone for
we
a quick
were just
second.
Doing the commentary yesterday.
I would say.
I saw on Twitter here, there was John, some, there was some talking one. About it.
Yeah,
I
easily.
Love it.
It there was some, a lot of. There was shots of tequila not taken by me.
Good for
I
you.
Just had beer.
Stay away from that shit.
Joel McHale has just joined the fold.
Hello. I was just talking about myself. And,
So, Simon.
You've been on The Soup, right?
I have, yeah.
Spin-off of Web Soup.
A couple of times, yeah.
Yes, The Soup is spun-off. This is the loudest thing that's ever been in my ear.
You have a volume control.
We did a funny skit where I screamed at Joel and was appeared to be a nasty person, didn't we?
Yeah.
Me and Jess were on for Spaced as well. And I had that amazing time with Keith Olbermann. We were yelling about some show.
It was you guys agreed to be on the show, and Keith Olbermann was already booked on the show. And they're like, what do we do? We're like, combine them. It'll be like peanut butter and chocolate. It was, and I still count it as one of the finest moments we've ever had on the show.
It was a hoot.
It was 1,000 times better.
Did you guys know each other before The Soup?
Of your appearances. No.
We hadn't met, had we, before The Soup days?
No, but I had followed you since.
And you, and I you. Uh-huh. I was in, when I was making, I just did a film in Vancouver and I was, you know, I was away from home and so I was relying on DVD to keep me company. The season one box set of Community became like my best friend. Yes. I kind of watched it like 6 times. Like sad. And all the extras and everything and like all the commentaries.
And then Dan Harmon found out that you...
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
And there was an ejaculation. And
just a trickle. It was like a pre. It was like a little bit of a pre.
It was a
full, full? Full
no,
on?
No, it was ejaculate and semen. It was both.
Oh, my God.
It was all there.
Full pregnancy.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It was thick.
Oh, glad to be of help.
I was just asking Simon, and I think this is a great question for you, not to all of a sudden turn this into a crazy interview thing, but just the idea of... how we get so used to flying under the radar. I mean, like the first, I'm sure you felt like in the first few seasons of The Soup, like, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah,
who
the
gives
first
a shit?
6 years.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, everyone's watching you now. Everything you do kind of.
The
you
cool
know.
People were watching.
Oh, very
but
well.
There's
played.
So much more of them than there used to be. That's
there
the
really
thing.
Are, Joe McHale.
Well, we our ratings are down.
All right.
Oh, so I think people got tired of it after a while. No, yes. And the fact that there was a British version of The Soup that failed miserably.
Oh, did it?
They had us on, and it was doing so well that they were like, let's do a British version. And then that failed so horribly, and then they put us back on, and we've never recovered.
That's because we hate ourselves. That's the absolute truth. We have this kind of thing. America is so glamorous and foreign and exotic and cool. And then if we see our own backyard, it's like, I don't want to see that. It's horrible. Just some person that I might see in London. Boring.
And see, we have the other thing. We're like, oh, everything that comes out of England, they all sound much better. They're all more educated. Their movies are better. They sound better.
Everyone sounds like you could. Whatever the equivalent of a British redneck is, would still sound smarter than our smartest
a
person.
Chav. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. We have a show called Jeremy Kyle. And it's one of those I am my sister's brother's dad. Kind
okay,
of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we got him. We got him.
There was a while when infomercials were even, well, when they first started, they were kind of like fascinating as to how horrifying they were.
Yeah.
And they always would put a British person
in them. Yeah, I know that.
Joel, I know sometimes you're at home and you're like, how do I clean off this window?
That's what I'm
with
always
just
thinking.
A rag.
It's impossible.
Well, now it's super rag.
Thank you, smart person.
You're welcome.
The amount of times I've been like in LA with jet lag and not been able to sleep and switched on TV and seen this weird guy, this weird British guy demonstrating some paint system or... a thing that chops up onions quick.
Yeah.
And everyone being amazed at it. It's very Frank Weir. Look, I'm going to do this really quickly. I'm going to get this over here. Mate. Chips.
I don't know what he's saying, but it's smart, whatever it is.
I'll buy it. Nine of them.
Take my money, charming British academic.
And I think right now there's a commercial, or it was running about turning something into gold.
Cash. Turning gold into cash.
And it was a British woman.
It wasn't thread,
whole.
Was it?
No, I don't.
Thread into goes Rumpelstiltskin. He's still around.
And you lose your child.
This is our Stillskin.
Hello, our Stillskin.
But there's a British. A woman. She's like, your cash can become gold right now.
It's hypnotic, isn't it?
And I'm just like, I don't care what.
And at that point, your pants are down, and you're just massaging your genitals up against the screen because the voice. I still maintain that if I could fuck a name, it would be Pippa Middleton. That is the most fuckable name I've ever heard in my life.
She's the why don't I know this name?
Pippa Middleton, Kate Middleton's sister.
Is that her sister? Oh, she's dating. I don't care.
A guy.
See, I'm not.
Well, they just broke up. If you're following the news, she's on the market now. You know,
but her real name is Philippa, isn't it?
Now there was a joke I heard that was someone told me this recently that I can say on here was It's one of those what is the difference, but it's not. It's why have Harry Potter books and what of Harry? This is it. Okay, rewind. What have the Harry Potter books and Pippa Middleton's bottom got in common?
What?
Oh no, hang on. I supposed to have said J.K. Rowling's famous because they both had Harry in them. And it still works. I didn't think it through.
Still works.
You say overused?
And you think British comedy is sophisticated? Really?
Well, I did until I went. I mean, I've told the story a million times on the podcast, but I the only examples of British comedy I had seen were like the top British comedies.
Yeah. We all have our shit, don't
and
we?
Then so I went over there. I was like, what is this?
That's why I'm always amazed when like. I've spoken to some Americans who will immediately talk about Benny Hill and Are You Being Served like it was the absolute summit of our comedic output. It's like, oh, don't misrepresent me like that. It's terrible.
I remember hearing that because Monty Python was so big here, and then I remember someone said, oh, well, Benny Hill just blew it away in the ratings every single week. It never was as big as Benny Hill.
Because it was massively mainstream. It was women in bikinis being chased by small, bald men. I mean,
stop it!
This is...
Classic. But you think about the legacy of at least in America. I mean, when Benny Hill died, people were like, "Oh, okay." Yeah.
He died very poor and very sad. It was awful.
Did he really?
Yeah, it's one of those.
What happened?
Stories. People eventually did lose interest in it. The show got tired. He couldn't get hired. He couldn't get arrested, and he died in poverty. And
I mean, I assume that's one of those shows that's sort of like, my parents watch that show. Like your parents watch that show eating TV dinners.
Well, when the Young Ones came out, which we were talking about earlier on, that's when a lot of the old guard, the old comics, became very bitter and angry because they were being made obsolete by these young punks, you know. A lot of hate.
I have a poster of Nigel Planer. Like, one of my favorite fucking jokes in all of television is Neil telling, I think he's telling Rick that he can't commit suicide by crucifying himself.
Yeah.
He's like, I've tried it hundreds of times, man. There's no way to hammer in the last nail. That's the fucking best.
It was the most amazing show.
Why it was on two seasons?
It's the curse of the two seasons. It's the British comedy curse.
No, that's interesting. So, you know, I always wonder, as British actors, you must never feel any security because British television is like, yeah, we'll do 6 episodes and then fuck off. Like, do you ever feel like on Friends, they would want that show to run 15 seasons if it could. But it seems like there's a different bit of
psyche. It's just a different dynamic. There's a weird thing where, I mean, when we made Spaced, it was like, the guy said, do you want to, we said, we'll do 7 episodes. No, we said, we'll do 6. And the guy said, how about 7? And we went, all right. Like, it was a weird number. And then when we got to the end of the second season, the only reason we didn't do more is because we couldn't be bothered. And because it was so difficult. Oh, that sounds awful. The truth is, it was such a hard show to make because the conditions were tough. Edgar, it was like making a movie in 8 weeks, like a big movie in 8 weeks, a 3-hour movie. And then after the second season, we had this idea to make this little zombie film as something to do different, you know, because it would make a change. And then everything changed. And we didn't want to go back to working in TV. That was hell. As much as we love that show and I miss everybody in it and I would love to have done a third season at least, it just wasn't worth it, you know.
And that zombie movie was a little thing called Zombieland.
A little movie you might have heard of.
I don't want to toot my own horn.
And isn't it also because it's BBC, there's something about it, because it's state-run, there's no reason to go further?
It's just a different thing. There's a different writing style. There's a different, different legislation about episodes.
Even Doctor Who, it's like, I want more money. Yeah, well, it sounds like you're about to regenerate.
See ya.
Well, with American TV, they're like, this thing's working. Order 36 of them for this season.
And put it on 5 nights a week.
7 years.
I know. But it's weird. But I find it's really weird that, you know, great television, good television, it disappears. Like, shows get cancelled that are amazing, but just because it's so cutthroat here.
Yeah.
Everyone got so pissed off at the end of Lost because of the ending, because they expected all of the questions that were thrown up to be answered. Those guys were just throwing things in the air to keep people watching. They didn't intend to answer any of that stuff. They didn't know they were going to be on next week, let alone next fucking year.
Yeah.
That's why, well, with British shows, which is always sometimes brilliant, because they're like, we have 12 chances to do this, and it will be finished.
Yeah.
And so then it's complete.
Yeah, and then you're done. And shows very rarely get cancelled mid-season in the UK. There might just be one season of 6 episodes, but they rarely get taken off mid-season. I mean, that's so demoralizing. Like, you know, particularly when it's great, good shows. You know, like say Battlestar Galactica, say, which was great television, and was constantly fighting to stay alive. It's weird.
I assume you probably kind of like working on a thing for a little bit, moving on, starting something new. You wouldn't want to linger on something for, like, I'm sure there must have been a Shaun of the Dead 2. What do you guys think? And you must,
From Dust Till Shaun. It came up.
Now, if you could have gotten Clooney to do it.
It would have been in. But
you'd also have to use Julia Lewis. So,
you get that too. That's the package.
It swings and roundabouts. I think it would be silly to do it because we had an idea of doing it again, maybe the same story, the same characters, but different monster, because it would be pointless to do a sequel because one of the main characters, who is probably the most loved character in the film, is dead.
Yeah.
So what would be the point of doing a sequel? It doesn't have to have a sequel.
That is a true nerd who knows, like, no, we don't want to, you know, there's not going to be like Shaun of the Dead 4, The Naked Mile with Eugene Levy, and you guys aren't even in it, and they've cast Shaun of the Dead.
Did someone from Paramount just slowly close a briefcase full of money and go, like, really?
Really?
Hey, Sean, meet Stifler's brother.
Yeah. They're the weird mashups.
Well, that's like, you know, with the whole Spaced remake thing, it was like, they didn't tell us about it. I mean, this is old news, but the idea when we were talking to them, going, what are you doing with our child? Why are you taking this away? The whole thing was, you should be pleased. Why are you upset? Like, genuinely couldn't understand why we were so affronted by the idea.
But I like how they kind of treated you like children. Yeah. They're like, what? You should be happy.
You're
right
not happy.
Now.
It's going to America.
The episode of The Simpsons where Monty Burns builds this environmentally friendly plant and Lisa's all excited, but then it turns out he's just turning all the fish into slurry. He's like, you can't help but be evil. Like, that's the network. Like, well, I don't see what the problem is.
I know.
And is it true? Because Richard Iuard,
directed an episode, right?
Yes. Yeah. He directed the My Dinner with Andre episode of Community. Thursday nights on NBC, 8 o'clock. He was talking. Central. He is, as you know, the most debilitatingly humble person that ever existed.
Yes.
Well, he's like, that's no way to make money in television. And in fact, I've lost money.
Oh God! The Marenghi guys. Geez, it's a tragedy story that we were talking about Garth Marenghi earlier on. The Avalon, the company that owned the rights to that show, don't let Matt Holness use it anymore. So this character, which is his, he's kind of just stopped doing stuff because he feels so disillusioned with the business because they basically just said, you can't do that anymore.
I was like, stop.
One season of one of the greatest TV show comedies ever, I think.
And he can't go do that character anywhere else.
Exactly.
So, it's like Paul McCartney having to pay Michael Jackson to play his own music.
Still.
Sick.
Still.
Death, he still has to pay.
As growing up as a, well, first of all, I'm so sorry. We haven't really talked about the book Nerd Do Well.
Oh yes. I have a book,
which is exciting. I mean, like you and, I mean, I said this to Damon Lindelof was on a couple of weeks ago and I was like, you write Star Trek now, like just as a nerdy kid to know that you're part of that universe how does it not melt half your brain?
It does a bit. I took Damon out to see Attack the Block in the UK recently, which is a great movie. Great movie.
Did you see it?
I haven't seen it yet.
It's fantastic. Isn't it good?
And then the budget is so. When I heard the budget, my mouth dropped.
Yeah, it's a great.
Some of the most original creatures that I've seen.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah. And as a fan of that genre, I thought he'd like it. And I thought I could also maybe tease a bit of info out of him about Star Trek, the next Star Trek film.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like going on a date and trying to get to first base with a girl. Because I didn't want to be too obvious about it.
He would probably let you touch his dick before he would tell you about Star Trek 2.
He still didn't tell me.
How did you?
I was kind of like, oh, so how's it going with the old... Star Trek. trying to be really sort of laid back about it.
Simon, the movie's on. Come on, yeah. We're trying to watch the movie.
So what am I going to be in it more?
Your face comes through the popcorn box.
I need a lot of time, Damon.
Oh, this reminds me of that one thing in the new Star Trek.
Right? Right?
It's so similar.
I'm sure JJ gets them all to go on some sort of secrecy boot camp where they just learn how to not say anything.
Oh, they have to program them like Cold War era brainwashing.
Absolutely.
It's just lens flares.
We get nothing.
It's all completed, right?
The new Star Trek?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's done.
So, what's it about?
Scotty has a lot of sex.
Really?
With green women.
There's really no other characters, really. They were like, let's just focus on one character at a time. It'll be like Wolverine.
It's Scotty Origins. It's just
Scotty Origins.
Drunk in Aberdeen.
A lot of shots of him screaming at the sky and the cameras pulling up.
I used to love the episodes where the Kirk and Spock were stuck on the planet and Scotty was on the ship trying to get him back up. Yeah. Just do a whole movie like that.
I could spend the whole summer in the beer plant again. One of the complaints from some people about the new movie was that the engineering looked a bit like a large beer plant on Roscoe Boulevard.
What's wrong with that?
I don't know. I was like, we wanted it to look really industrial, like the inside of the Titanic, and make it look more like a big ship,
That'd be great during a really stressful scene with you out even breaking, just pour a pint and stop it.
Wait
and
there!
I mean, what was great about you, the original announcement of you as Scotty was, when people started hearing other cast members, and by the way, I think Carl Urban turned out to be phenomenal.
Oh, he knocked it out of the
park. When you first heard that, you're like, really? I don't know. But when it was like, Simon Pegg is Scotty, yes, of course. Okay, yes.
Not everyone.
Yes.
Some people were like,
really?
Constantly felt laser sighting on my neck during.
Well, that's there's always going to be a percentage of nerd culture that's angry no matter what.
Yeah, they're going to be angry they didn't reanimate what's his name's body and put him back in.
James Doohan, yeah. But my co-worker in the transporter room, the guy that sits next to me, is his son, is Chris Doohan, who's James Doohan's son. So I had my connection with the old guy, and everyone else, because apart from Carl, because obviously DeForest Kelly's died as well. They could reach out to their respective counterparts. But Chris took a while to get to Bill Shatner, and they'd meet eventually at a horse show or something.
Wait, wasn't that a pizza place?
Where you find Shatner.
Bill, it's me! Get away from me. I'm eating.
DeForest, is that you?
This did this start as a conversation about a book?
Sorry,
didn't finish talking about Richard Awadi, sorry.
Oh, well, just how you can't... He was going on and on how you can't make any money in British television.
Yeah.
And then he came out with Submarine.
Which is great.
Which is a great movie, which he also tried to prove to me that he would never make a dime and, in fact, would somehow be losing money and it would be terrible for his career. And I'm just keep talking until assisted suicide comes in.
Just typing, this is the no one's gonna. Why am I even?
Well, when you make... The truth is, when you make your first film and the studio takes a gamble on you, they cover their asses very, very well. So you don't really see anything from... Sometimes it is slightly galling to see an action figure of yourself and know that you will never have any compensation for it whatsoever.
That first thing is sort of like, I think, what models do when they have to go out and build up their book.
Yeah.
This is what I do.
It's a means to an end, love.
Yeah, they go, you're not going to make it in the first one, but the second movie.
Exactly.
Which means now you flew here in a Bentley jet.
A gold Bentley jet.
Wow.
Yep. Where the wings, and then it just lands. And also submersible.
Yeah.
So Nerd Do Well is sort of it's kind of autobiographical, growing up nerdy in England.
Yeah. I got the chance. I was going to do a book. I went to the publishing place. I said, can I do a book? It's like photographs of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and mine and Edgar's next one, like a compendium backstage scene, back behind the scenes photos kind of thing, because I take loads of pictures. And they went, why don't you write a memoir? And I thought, oh, that feels dirty, and I don't want to do that. And
why is that dirty?
Well, it just feels like, who cares what
I think it's
about.
Hard for British people because you guys don't like to talk about yourselves.
Exactly. And there's this sense of you see them on the shelves every year, smiling from the front of their books going, poor me and my life.
And then as a British person in the story, you're like, what? Look at that cunt.
That douche.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, I'll write a story of guy goes from doing space to doing Star Trek. And this seems like a nice journey from making a nerdy show like Space to being in a nerdy franchise like Star Trek. And that felt boring because it was just like I went into work and we had burritos that morning and it was boring. Filming's filming. It's great fun, isn't it? But you tell people about it and it's like, well, I wasn't there. What the fuck do I care?
Well, ours is very exciting because we have Chevy Chase around. But
I know. I saw saw the outtakes.
Yeah.
And hot girls as well.
We've got some. I'll send you some other outtakes.
Good. Can we talk off air? I then thought, well, the stuff that's more relatable, the stuff that actually people might read and think, oh, yeah, I felt a bit like that, would be when I was a kid. And then I thought, well, it's not so bad having to talk about your private life if you're in control of it and you mm-hmm. can say what's said. When you talk to a journalist about your private life, they take it away and they interpret it and they disseminate it how they wish, and that feels a bit weird. But doing it yourself, I kind of came around to the idea of being self-indulgent, egotistical.
But I think it makes sense from the lens of I was this nerdy kid. I'm doing everything that this nerdy kid could never have even dreamed would have happened.
That was the angle. It was like, look, I did, you know, like I met Tom Baker when I was 8, and then when I was 20, whatever, 30, whatever, I was in Doctor Who, and I went to see Star Trek when I was this, and then I was with Leonard Nimoy in 2009, and all those little circularities seemed kind of, you know,
but then you would
interesting.
Have to, would you say that in Hot Fuzz, you played the badass?
I did play the badass.
You were the cool badass.
He's not a nerd, yeah. No. I get annoyed when people say, oh, he plays the same part all the time, because I didn't once.
So, but you played a very convincing badass.
I did, just because I can, you know, I can kick it. I just don't like to show it.
What is the next thing you're working on with Edgar?
It's the title's out there. It's the moment. It's called World's End, and it's something that we are going to fiercely guard with JJ-like intensity.
Sure.
But it'll be the next one. We kind of say it's going to be like Shaun of the Dead times Hot Fuzz. That will be what the product of that equation will be, The World's End.
So it's pretty indie, like My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah. Exactly.
It is My Dinner with Andre. It's just Nick and Simon at a table at a restaurant wrestling. Just talking.
Sidney Poitier comes in.
Yeah. It's me and Nick wrestling in front of a fireplace.
And while a Sean.
And there is.
There are a lot of zombies around here, aren't there?
They can just throw them in there.
Inconceivable. Wow.
But we're hopefully going to do. We're trying to get on it right now. I'm hopefully going to see him today, and we're going to make a plan to. Because it's been weird, because he's over here now, and we're trying to get in a room and write together. But when I come over for Star Trek, when that happens, then we might be able to, you know, get working.
Well, we're at the end of our hour, and I know you have to go because you're doing Attack of the Show today. But I do want to say.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, congrats.
Thanks.
Yeah, he's doing Attack of the Show.
No, a lot of people see that.
Now, it seems like you're suggesting a lot of people don't see that by your tone.
Well, why would you say? Well, no,
because I work on the channel.
I literally said that.
And I know a lot of people don't see it. Oh, my God.
I literally said.
Are you being self-effacing or sarcastic? I just
It's both. He has an amazing ability to do both. It's like a 1-2 swipe.
With Awadi too much.
It's like he'll stab you and then stab back at himself at the same time. It's genius. It's so endearing.
No,
it's
I'll
so
be like, oh, I could beat the crap out of you, but you're so wonderfully skinny.
Yes, exactly. I'm like, I don't know how to feel about dirt, but
you're just
I can't come at you.
I wish I had
just hold
your
me
body fat percentage.
But I do want to thank you not only for making such great landmark pieces within the nerd culture, but also respecting the nerd culture. And I think one of the great things about Paul was seeing, like, you guys didn't make fun of Comic-Con, which is like a studio would be like, yeah, let's make fun of these fucking nerds. Like, you genuinely. These characters were sincere about it, and you didn't shit on the culture, and I think that's really cool.
Some people complained about that. It was like, they were just at Comic-Con, and no one sort of punched anyone or gave anyone a wedgie. It was like, well, we didn't want it.
And that's not what, that literally doesn't happen at Comic-Con.
Of course, exactly, yeah.
Are you going to be at Comic-Con?
Not this year. It always falls on my wedding anniversary, so this year I'm going to put my wife first.
You shouldn't go, because there's a lot of really weird burnt offering altars to you.
You know, it's so weird. That's
raise
like,
a goat and lower
I can't because it's where the majority of the people that like our stuff they tend to be there. We're more famous there than we are anywhere in the world. So it's like being a Beatle there. It's quite weird. You can't get out of the hotel and you have to wear a mask to go on the floor to do anything normal. And it's a bit of a shame really because I can't enjoy it like I used to. But it's still. I saw when we were there doing the pool panel after you moderated the pool panel. Sigourney Weaver went out onto the floor dressed as Batman so she could have a shop.
That's awesome. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, she looked better than any of the Batmen from the films because she's much taller and, you know.
She's nicer. Wonderful.
Yeah, she melts my
great
heart.
Great jawline.
Yeah.
Everything about her is. I, at Comic-Con, like, you know, oh, can you sign them? Like, oh, great, this is so great. And then I start getting in my head, like, I think I'm kind of famous. And then I'll go to, you know, then I'll go to, like, Wisconsin to do a show. And they're like, please, everyone, no. Oh, there are no photographs. All right.
No one.
All right. I'm on. Oh, gee. Okay.
Yeah, it's a fake world.
It is, but a wonderful one.
Are you bringing your child over here?
I will for after Star Trek. She was born here. She's a Californian.
She's got dual citizenship.
Yeah, she is. She could be president. Yeah, I had her in St. John's.
Where? Oh, at St. John's.
Yeah. Matilda. She's. I can't wait to bring her back because she's. I love the fact she was born here. I'm proud to have a little American as a child.
That's awesome. Sort of like the Blade of England and America. It's like, all our strengths, none of our weaknesses.
The day walker. The day toddler.
The day toddler. It's the day toddler.
Isn't it great international flights with children?
We've done a couple of short ones since.
You can't put them in the cargo hold anymore, is that
not
correct?
Anymore.
You cannot, because too many of them are dying from lack of oxygen.
Damn it!
Is that why it is?
Oh. No.
I don't know.
The dog is coming over as well. All the pegs are coming over. Yeah. It's going to be, I can't wait
to
get back.
The dog will go in the hold.
She does go in the hold. She went in last time she came over in the hold. It wasn't too bad for her either.
Yeah, they figured it out.
Yeah.
They don't accidentally freeze them to death.
I thought she'd be like a wreck when we got her out of freight, but she was fine.
Everything's fine.
Yeah.
Well, Simon Pegg, this was a wonderful pleasure and an honor. Great. And Joel McHale!
Thank you for letting me
Thank you for
in
coming
here.
In. This was so great
me?
To this have was, you drop by. We're recording this like 3 feet from the soup set, so it was just, nice, it was just a nice thing.
But if
that
you think about it, you're recording this from 3 feet from every set.
Everything here at the,
No, have a great time at Attack of the Show. I hope they give you a cassette tape of it.
Some rare kapow.
I'm sorry. That's all right. I can't help but make fun of
you. I don't blame you. Listen, Joel, G4 is seen by hundreds of people. I don't know why you keep...
And that doesn't even include the staff that make sure it's working on the air.
Yeah, I mean, of course that doesn't include the DirecTV people. You know. But anyway, there's hundreds of people who are really into it.
No, I hope you have some other great appearances. I assume they're like G4, so you're going to go to a park and just read aloud something.
It just keeps coming, doesn't it?
I'll stop right now.
Stop sexually assaulting my work. All right, Simon, Nerd Do Well is a book. It is available now. Please buy it. And thank you so much for being here, Simon Pegg and Joel McHale. And also Jonah and Matt. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. It's just something we say at the end of the show.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome, Joel.
Thank you. All right.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This delightful episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by GoToMeeting, the award-winning web conferencing service. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and enter the promo code Nerdist.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.